Station number 11944.
He's on a Judge Jala and Rule 14. You were saying this didn't exist, this
No,
unit, or
but
it was.
the officers and men were drawing their pay, and they were obtaining the spare parts with which to carry out the repairs by cannibalizing vehicles which they'd stolen from various units up and down the canal.
I think you were telling me there was another racket involving the building of a road.
Yes, that was another one that I heard about at that time, where the a road was to be built across the desert. It employed a number of men, hundreds of civilians. It was staffed by again officers and men who deserted or were absent without leave, and the road was being built so far, and it reached the officers' mess and went round the corner, and any visiting dignitary got as far as the mess and then accepted an invitation to have a gin and tonic and never went any further. The road only just went round the corner from the mess, and for some time, months or years maybe, but all that time the people running the racket were drawing money from the field post paymaster by producing quittance rolls with thumbprints and hieroglyphics indicated being signed by the various labourers, Egyptian labourers involved. And again, that must have gone on for some time before they were caught. But that again is second hand as far as I'm concerned. I was not personally involved in that.
Were there any shortages on Cyprus when you were there?
No. No, it
Well
was.
supplied with food and so on.
Oh, Cyprus was well provided. It was very cheap. You could get accommodation there, civilian accommodation. Could rent a very nice villa for about £2 a week, and it was a very popular, fashionable place. And of our headquarters officers at Wolseley Barracks, I think there were 14 of them altogether on the staff. And no fewer than six took their release in Cyprus because they wanted to settle there afterwards. It was a beautiful island. I fell in love with the place. I was tempted at one stage to stay, but I didn't in the end. And but it was lovely. The people were kind. The troubles with Makarios, Bishop Makarios, and the other troubles, of course, were in the future. And it was an idyllic island. It was lovely. It was. I was up in the hills one day, and the afternoon, and I heard a shepherd coming. I could hear his bell on his goats ringing. So they tinkled along as they came down the valley or round the valley, and the shepherd was playing a pair of pipes. Of the and on that occasion, I remember thinking at the time, if Pan had come round the corner, I wouldn't have raised an eyebrow. I was it was a lovely place, and of course, going back to the history of the Crusades and the Lusignans and the Turks, and it was a wonderful island, and I was very, very happy there. But this was it was a we were quite busy. We hadn't got a lot of troops there at the time, but it was a very important staging post. We did come across in my fire, my safe. I had in fact the plans for what the island should do if the Germans came after the Battle of Crete. And you may recall that after the Battle of Crete, Winston Churchill had expressed regret at having lost Crete, but challenged the Germans to try attacking English property such as Cyprus, where they would find things very different from Crete. And at that time, the plans were to deal with that eventuality. And they consisted quite shortly of everybody getting into a lorry and going down to Famagusta and getting across to Palestine as fast as they could, because at the time Churchill gave that challenge, There were not 100 troops in Cyprus, defending Cyprus. There were no anti-aircraft guns, no tank guns, nothing, just bare infantry, one company of bare infantry.
Sounds like he was doing a double bluff.
Oh, yes, not half, and it worked. Anyway, the my troubles were to come later on during that period with Heskamp. Now, at that time, there was trouble with Israel, and Palestine, the Zionists, and the King David Hotel had been blown up by the Stern Gang, and the Ergun Sfar Leumi were very active. And we were conscious of this, and we were conscious of the fact we might have to give them help. When I say they, the people in Palestine. And to that end, they had set up a camp called X Camp. And X Camp was commanded by Captain Campion and by a corporal and, I think, one private soldier. And they had run X Camp for some time. It provided accommodation for approximately 250 men. It had a wire fence round it, and it would provide a secure area in which to keep any illegal immigrants, the Jewish people trying to get to Palestine, who might be brought to the island by the Royal Navy, who were patrolling the Palestine coast at the time. And Captain Campion was a very popular, very jolly sort of man, and he knew that he was in a good billet there, and never ceased to boast about it. I was playing tennis one Sunday afternoon, and I got a signal from the War Office in London, because we had a direct air link to Whitehall, and the signal which was brought to me on the tennis court was to the effect that we must be prepared to accept illegal immigrants who had been intercepted by the Royal Navy. It was believed that there were approximately 2,000 illegal immigrants. It was believed that 1,700 of them were women. And it was again believed that no fewer than 1,400 were pregnant and were 8 months pregnant. And we were to be ready to receive and provide shelter for these people. Well, at that time, there were 6 maternity beds in the whole of Cyprus. We had no accommodation for anybody on that scale, and we just didn't know what to do. Mrs. Anstis, the commander's wife, was extremely successful in getting quantities of such things as sanitary towels, which we didn't know, we were young men, we didn't know how to set about that, but she got the Red Cross to get some for us. Some of the engineers made little cots for the babies out of pieces of wood and cut up tents. We made little hammock beds for these people. It was all very much of a mess and difficult. And I communicated with GHQ Cairo, and I wanted help, and I said I was in a mess. And they said they'd not to worry, they'd provide all the stores we needed for this camp, and that not only would they provide the materials, but they'd provide the men to use them, set up a new camp, a large ex-camp. And in due course, these stores started to come in. They were being flown in, corrugated iron, wood, wire, posts, anything we needed, really. And I went down to Nicosia Main Airport to welcome the labourers who were going to put the camp up for us, or a large ex-camp. And I must say, having had no prior warning, I was astonished when the labourers emerged from their plane to find that they were all ex-members of the Africa Corps. They're all German prisoners of war who'd been sent to do this work. Very nice German officer in charge, major. And I remember the consternation I caused him and his men when I told him that he and his people were to provide facilities for about 2,000 Jews. And they immediately set to work and they insisted on using the materials first to make a big secure camp for themselves to keep the Jews out when they came. And having done that, they then set to work and they extended X camp for us. Now, these Jewish people, we found out later, had come that they were nearly all Russians. They were people from most of them had served in the Russian army. They were aged late teens, early 20s. They were all tough, fit military men and women, real toughs. They weren't the little ladies with black on pushing prams across France, the refugees we'd seen in photographs and picture posts in the 1940s. And they had been brought by the Russians and were being used deliberately to make our situation in Palestine and the Middle East general unstable to the advantage of the Russians. The women had all been taken to one particular camp on the edge of the Adriatic, where they had been impregnated expressly with the idea of causing complications and getting what they called internal immigration into Palestine. And so that the whole thing was a Russian operation, which of course was welcomed by the Jewish people. When they came, and again I went to meet them at the Farm Augusta and saw these people on the boats with the naval being brought in by the Navy, they really were a most hostile and aggressive type, and they were throwing things at us, they were shouting obscenities, they were urinating on the troops, spitting on them. And of course for a lot of our men, who like myself had been halfway across Europe being cheered as liberators, to be treated like this was something of a shock. Anyway, we finally got them to their camp, and there they remained until the in due course they were taken across to Palestine in small batches.
So they were allowed in?
They were allowed
into Palestine
eventually. There was nowhere else for them to go. They couldn't stay in Cyprus indefinitely in this camp. And so it was a case of regulating them, more or less. And that was, of course, part of what we did with the, in order to carry out our mandate in Palestine.
How did the soldiers respond when they were subject to all this abuse?
They were magnificent. I really was. I felt. I mean, they really were urinating and spitting on them. And I never saw anybody hit anybody with a rifle butt or anything like that. They didn't kick anybody or charge them or do anything. They were completely passive and let them do it. I think a lot of us at the time felt sorry for these people. They were Jews. We'd heard about the Holocaust. We'd heard about Belsen and Auschwitz. And they wanted to go to their homeland, and they had no homeland, and that was that. But it was quite a remarkable period from my point of view, and it really was the end of my career there. And in due course, I managed to get my release, and I was very fortunate in being able to arrange that I should get a Class C release, which is a compassionate release, because of my studies. By this time it would be September or so, October. And so I was able to get the compassionate release to go back to continue my studies at the university. When I got to Cairo, I lost my C release papers and produced the B release papers, which entitled me to longer leave and so on, but insisted that I get on the first boat available to go home on the Medlock route again. And when I got to England, I produced my A release papers, which entitled me my demob suit and my 3 months leave or whatever it was from overseas service, and my full entitlement, as there was, I was in. So happened that I had all of the entitlements. There was nothing improper in it. I was entitled to all those releases. So I got back to the university.
You never felt tempted to stay in the army?
I had the most terrible period of release leave. Because of this, I went back to the university on a further education scheme grant. I was a married man, and I was therefore entitled to £240 a year allowance. That was the grant that I was to receive as a student after 6 years in the army. If I stayed on in the army, and I should say that there was a certain amount of pressure on me in view of the illegal immigrants and the general situation out there, if I'd stayed on, and I heard this from GHQ Cairo, where they sent for me to discuss my military secretary's service with me, they said that I would be confirmed in a majority. If I signed on, I would be confirmed in the majority. They would have my wife out with me in Cyprus within a fortnight. They would provide with a married quarter, and that I would be guaranteed the position for not less than 12 months. And at that time, with allowances and everything else, I was earning about £2,500 a year with a pension. And therefore, and I was told that I had until the end of my release leave to pick up the telephone and ring a number which they gave me in London, in the military sector's branch, presumably, and Aladdin's Cave would be open to me. And my wife and I discussed this. We worried and worried, because there was a lot of difference in those days between a new career as a student with everything in doubt at the end of it, nothing certain, and an established career in a job I knew and which I liked. So for that reason, I very, very nearly signed on. I would happily have signed on. I'm glad I didn't. And I'm glad I didn't largely because, as a result of the army again, about 3 years later, I was called up for what was called Z training. And this was a system whereby they were, I think it was probably the time of career or about that time, when they were going to make sure they had a hold on their reservists. And of course, having been in the army, I was still on the reserve. And so they therefore called us out for some training. And it is in a remarkable way, because they picked... I was presumably one of the younger ones with Asian Service Group and so on. But although I'd been with the Border Regiment, with the King's Own, and with the Durham Light Infantry, they sent me to the Lancashire Fusiliers, not in Manchester, but at Bury. I'd no connection with the Lancashire Fusiliers, I knew nothing about them, I didn't really want to. I'd been through a rifle company and done the jobs there, and I'd also had a certain amount of administrative experience. But they didn't make use of any of that history, and they put me in charge of the Pioneer Platoon, dealing with mines and booby traps and so on, and work that I just didn't know and didn't want to know particularly when there was no war on. I was given a whole lot of ex-clerks and cooks and so on, duty men of one sort or another, who didn't want to be Z-men either. And unfortunately, I don't like to say this, but the Lancashire Fusiliers, and that particular battalion of the Lancashire Fusiliers, treated its Z officers abominably. They distinguished us with badges which showed who were the battalion and the TA and who were the Z men. We had flashes which indicated that we weren't regulars, and we were more or less frozen out the whole of the fortnight we were on Salisbury Plain. I had a rotten time. I didn't enjoy it. It gave me a very bad impression of the Lancashire Fusiliers. But what it did do, for the plus, was that it showed me in no uncertain manner that I could never have soldiered in peacetime. And also it had the effect that, well, in due course, the Territorial Army was reformed and units were set up in my own vicinity. I lived in Manchester in those days. I just refused to join. Had I been near Durham, had I been near the Border Regiment, perhaps, I would have joined. And I would have, I think I would have probably have enjoyed being with them and done a good job. But in the circumstances, when the time came that it set the unit up, I wanted nothing to do with them. Largely because of the Z training.
But at the time when you were having to make this decision, when you were on your release leave, what was it that persuaded you, singly and collectively, that you would take the option of being a penniless student rather than staying in the army? Can you remember what it was? That
I don't remember now. I suppose I was destined for the law anyway. My father was a barrister and later to become a judge. My sister was also a practicing barrister and very active and successful. And I suppose really the lure of the law took over in the end. But it never ceased to, I've never ceased to be very proud to have been with the Durham Light Infantry. I'm basically a soldier. When I was at the bar, when I became a judge, barristers submitting pleas in mitigation never failed to tell me that their criminal had served with distinction with such and such a regiment. They knew quite well where my heart lay, and also, of course, I'm very proud of the fact that my son's with the Grenadier Guards now. So obviously the stories I told him in his youth probably affected him and made him want to join the Honourable Artillery Company and the Grenadiers.
Do you think you learned any valuable lessons from your military service?
Oh yes, very much so. We grew up at high speed. I'd mentioned already that we were only 20, 21, that sort of age, but we were men. I learnt, I think, to know myself. And I think I learnt to know myself in such a way that I believe that I know now how I would react in certain conditions and certain situations. There are occasions when I know perfectly well I would get out of the position and run away if necessary, preserve myself. There are other occasions when I know quite well that there'd be no alternative but to stand and face whatever it was and get on with it. And I think it gives you a certain self-confidence. It also, and I think that's one of the differences between the people who served during the war and who feel they know themselves, and those who have come after us and who happily have not had to fight, but who wonder how they would behave in that situation. And I've noticed this so often. There are people who, I think, have a little question mark, as they'd like to be heroes, they'd like to do a good job, they'd like to be brave, but there's always the little question mark. Would they? Could they do it themselves? Could they kill somebody? Would it upset them to kill somebody? Well, of course, as far as that's concerned, those who served in the war and they actively know the answer to that, as far as they themselves are concerned. The younger people who haven't had the experience didn't know. I think it gave, in that way, I think it gave people confidence. I think it gave them status, and a feeling of self-confidence, status. Swank, if you like. It gave them bags of swank. They'd served, they'd done it, and so on. And so it did make a big difference in that way, I think, to me.
Is there any way in which you can tell in advance how any individual is going to behave in battle? And for how long they can stick it?
Well, obviously, sir, people who are white-faced and their teeth chattering and their eyes rolling are not going to be terribly trustworthy, and that did happen, of course, but on the other hand, we did have trouble in Normandy in that there was a certain amount of desertion and people going absent and so on. And unfortunately, the people to whom it happened were very often the people who'd won MMs in the desert and who had mentioned in dispatches and so on, men you'd trust your right arm with. And they cracked.
Presumably they just had enough.
They'd had enough. They were war weary. And there was nothing you could do about it. We used to, if we saw signs of this sort of thing, we used to tip off the medical officer with regard to any individual, just say, I think he's cracking. And the doctor used to write on the man's records, battle neurosis. Well, battle neurosis, ? Which meant that if he did go, he was covered, wouldn't be court-martialed.
And how were they treated? Were they ever sent out of the line for a while to recover? And
no, if you'd sent them out of the line, everybody would have gone. We'd have all been jumping on the wagons to go with them. Oh, no. And one of my officer friends, a chap called Jimmy Randall, always said you could tell a person who was a deserter and who was really gone round the bend by ordering him to stop and tell him to go back the other way. And if he turned around and went back towards the other way, he was battle neurosis. But if he insisted on going back towards base, then he was having him on. And he taught me that little trick in Cyprus, in Sicily.